it may be summed up, as I conceive it, as the right to choose art freely. No reason is required of us. I like it because I like it. I feel much the same way about religion, hence my resistance to being an advocate or an adversary, read missionary. I taught classical music appreciation to thousands of University of Utah students, and I continue to give pre-concert lectures for symphony and opera on a regular basis. And while I really enjoy sharing my enthusiasm for things I like, I always try to find what I call an additive approach. I don't want people to give up anything which nourishes them in a positive way. My best hope as a teacher is to enlarge the scope of artistic experience that can bring a person happiness. So you add, if there's something I know and you think you are missing something, then I'm happy to add to your bundle. That's how I operate. I urge all to respect the familiar while being willing to embrace a larger world of music, whatever that is. If you love Bach, then I'm going to become an advocate for Schoenberg. And if you love Schoenberg and cannot handle Mozart, which was my case for about 20 years, the reverse is true. I needed Mozart. If a person chooses to invite me to testify as to what makes me happy, as on this occasion, I'm anxious to oblige. Otherwise, I keep my opinion to myself. It is my observation that effects derived from experience with works of art are in general short-lived. That is, by the time you get home after the concert, you feel differently than you did while it was happening. Art at its best is not a substitute for life. A condition of both art and life is that both require renewal and repetition and rebirth. The ability to sustain sufficient awareness of each repetition so that it's life-affirming and creative is a major challenge to us. During my tenure as music director for Ballet West, I conducted nearly 1,000 performances of Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker. It takes an hour and 30 minutes, approximately, to get through it. One of my greatest gifts is a very short musical memory, which has a bearing in this instance. Every time I heard it, I thought it was brand new. Every performance was exciting to me. Performances in Utah with the Utah Symphony usually numbered as many as 30 in a season. And by January 1st, many of the members of the symphony were climbing the walls. It's easier for the conductor than it is for the guys who can't see the stage. Even so, it is easy by the 30th performance to take a miraculously inventive score for granted. I learned a vital lesson from a lawnmower repairman years ago when I was still mowing a large lawn every week. By the midsummer, the thing would sound like a diesel truck. And when I sensed that it was on the edge of death, I would take it to my man in Rose Park. And he would crank it up, and sometimes 50 times, and then there would be a wheeze, and maybe it would turn over, and he would listen, and he would smell it, and then he would indeed dive in a few moments it purred like a kitten. I learned much about artistry and excellence from the experience with that lawnmower man. I've always tried to approach a composition as if I believed it to be the greatest masterpiece ever written. Last night, we sang in the pillars of our faith four hymns. I would never choose any of them. But when I'm performing them, they are to me, and in that moment, the greatest pieces ever written. My answer to the question, what it takes for music to stir my soul, is the piece I love best is the one I am studying at this moment.
Thank you, Ardeen. We'll next hear from Alan Eastman.
I should be skinny again, but I'm not. You know, Ardeen, your comment about short musical memory, that's what they say of the advantage of getting Alzheimer's disease, is that every joke is brand new. You meet all kinds of interesting people.
I can tell you something about that, too.
It's probably worth telling you a little about myself so you'll know why I had the temerity to be even be on the same panel with these people. I'm not a professional musician. I suppose you could call me a semi-professional musician because I actually make some money at it from time to time. I really had considered saying that I don't make much, but if I said that, it would be hard to tell me from real professional musicians. What I usually tell people is that in, quote, real life, I'm a research chemist. I'm telling you this so you'll know and have some appreciation for why I have to analyze everything. You know, it's kind of in my blood one way or another. I started piano at age 10 after a couple of years of unsuccessfully battling the violin. Tell you how bad I was, the apex of my career as a violinist was when I was finally promoted to next to last chair second violin in the junior high orchestra. But maybe it was a reaction to the violin, but when I started piano, I got thoroughly hooked. I took my last piano lesson in high school, but I've had a jazz trio since then. I've studied organ with Dr. Kundig at the Tabernacle. I've been to jazz seminars with people like George Shearing and Doc Severinsen. You know, I've done all the things LDS musicians get kind of conned into. I've written pageants, I've done directed choirs, and I've been ward organist since Bach gave up the job. But currently, my most fun music job is playing at a restored 1870s pioneer village near my home in Oklahoma. The owner of the place is a sweet little lady who gets an enormous charge out of telling all her friends that she has a Mormon high priest playing honky-tonk piano in her saloon. Well, you know, no matter the context, music's a very personal thing, and Ardeen certainly brought out that music for him is a very personal thing, and it really is for all of us. You know, what I hear isn't the same as what you hear or what Ardeen hears. Some of that might be an artifact sitting too close to the drums in my 35 years with a trio, but there's more to it than that. You know, when we listen to a given composition, all of us are exposed to the same vibrations. That's the raw material of the music, is those two. Let's face it, I'm a physical scientist. I see it that way. You know, there are vibrations in the air that are the same for every one of us. But what we hear is a result of what our brain actually does to those vibrations after it gets past our ears and into the otic nerves and into our brain. The music really doesn't consist of what the composer wrote. It doesn't consist of the notes on the page. It doesn't even consist of the waves in the air. What music consists of is what we contribute to the vibrations. All the filters that we apply internally, and all the education and sensibility and sensitivity that we bring to those notes. Most of us cheat, incidentally. It's a lot easier to appreciate music with a text that reminds us of what we're supposed to be thinking about. I guess I could tell you an experience I had with our ward music chairman, who asked me to play something in church. And I said, well, how about, I've got a lovely arrangement of Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring. How about that? She said, does it have words? I said, well, yeah, but they're in German and you won't hear them when I'm playing the organ. All that would never do. That's not spiritual. So I suggested that maybe a good rousing chorus of We Are All Enlisted might do instead. And she said, oh, that'd be perfect. That wasn't quite what I had in mind. I still haven't played in church, incidentally. I'm on her blacklist, even though I'm the organ, the pianist for the choir. But, you know, atextual music can also be quite spiritual, as Ardeen quite usefully pointed out. But what we get out of atextual music basically depends on what we put into it. Now, my wife, when I was doing this, she suggested that you would certainly want to listen to something more gloriously tonal than my voice. So let's listen to a couple things that I find really quite spiritually meaningful. The first one, hope that works. I'm going to tell you about it first and then we'll listen. The first is a movement, and it's the third one from the Brahms Requiem, which I would like played at my funeral, by the way. And this is the baritone soloist asking all the hard questions. He says, Lord, make me to know the measure of my days on earth, to consider my frailty, that I must perish. And then echoing Ecclesiastes, he muses, surely all my days are as a handbreadth to thee. My lifetime is as naught to thee. Verily mankind walketh in a vain show, and their best state is vanity. Man passeth away like a shadow. He is disquieted in vain. He heapeth up riches and cannot tell who shall gather them. Now as this part is sung, the music gets more and more agitated until the dark, really kind of bitter musing ends in, now, Lord, what do I wait for? You know, take me now, I'm ready. That's a perfect existential moment. At that moment, the chord changes, and the key changes. And the chord changes from a rather anguished diminished seventh to a series of major chords ending in a pretty strong cadence. And we have this growing affirmation, my hope is in thee. Why? Well, now Brahms puts in this gorgeously written fugue on the words, but the righteous souls are in the hand of God, nor pain nor grief shall nigh them come. The interesting part is, no matter how elaborate and how exotic the chordal changes above it, or how many different keys he wanders into, and there are lots of them, there's one note that's sustained for about 3.5 pages in the score underneath everything. It's a D, and it just sits there. And it sits there, and it sits there, with all of this stuff going on top of it. Until finally, at the very end, the whole thing resolves into a nice D major chord, and that pedal D just reaches up and envelops the whole fabric of that word. I see that pedal D as representing the love of God that assuages the baritone's concerns and wraps up in its gentle mantle all the righteous, finally overcoming everything else, all the existential angst of the world in his grace. I really can't listen to this movement without feeling almost physically lifted above my momentary concerns. For me, this is an invitation and pathway to transcend the kind of petty vanities of our mortal life. So let's listen to it and see if you can follow. You know, let's face it, I'm a chemist. I'm not a professional musician, but I think that's a decent analysis.
one where you want big speakers and you turn it way up.
One more thing, I don't want to take everybody else's time. This thing takes a while to count all the tracks.
This one is atextual music, and it's something that probably none of you have heard. I don't know if you even... Do you know Carl Jenkins? Carl Jenkins is a contemporary composer who writes music for TV ads. And I guarantee you've all heard something of his. He wrote the string stuff that's behind the De Beers Diamond ads. And this is actually the second movement of the suite that he developed from that. It's... Unlike the Brahms, there's no text, but let me tell you what Vicki and I have come up with. It starts out as a series of chords, just chords in the bass, that are kind of like the world we live in. They're repetitive, slightly dissonant, just kind of dull life plodding along. A violin enters. It's kind of a lone voice trying to find harmony amid the changes that underlie all its efforts. After a time of wandering, and it's not without beauty, but it's kind of somber, a second voice joins in, supporting and enriching the harmony. We see this as the Lord supporting each of us by adding beauty and harmony to our life if we let it. The unisons are particularly exquisite, God singing our song along with us. Finally, at the end of the duet, everything resolves into sort of a divine harmony, nice major chord. The first ending is pretty sad when there's only one voice. The second time with both of them is sweet and beautiful. The contrast between one voice and two is like living with and without the Lord. I'm not going to say anything else, but just hear this music and then I'll give up the podium to the next lucky victim. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. We've just heard from Alan Eastman. We'll next hear from Violet Kimball.
I'm not a professional musician. I think Ardeen Watts is the only one up here who is. But I have studied voice for about 20 years in New York City and Munich and St. Louis and actually here in Salt Lake City. And I've sung opera, or I did sing opera for about 15 years. And I used to sing quite a bit in church and a few other places. And Stan always introduced himself as Violet's live-in accompanist. So we had classical music in our home from day one, and our children grew up around it. One of the most, memorable experiences that happened to one of our children is that when our oldest son was asked, the class was allowed to bring their favorite record to, I think he was in the 11th grade. And so they did. And our son took Night on Bald Mountain. And the rest of the kids were whatever was popular, I guess the Beatles. And did they ever make fun of him? He came home just crushed. They don't like my music. So That was pretty much a shocking experience for him. But after that, he kind of left classical music, went to the kind that everybody else was doing. So the title of my talk is Music, the Hope of the World. There is a powerful scene in the movie The Shawshank Redemption. A prisoner named Andy, who is in charge of the library, finds a box of classical records and a shipment of books. He picks up an album by Mozart and begins to play one selection on the library stereo system. This isn't just any music. It is The Marriage of Figaro. And the selection he's playing is called The Letter Duet. Two women sing this magnificent composition. As with most opera, the words are trite, you know, to Romeo, where the sun is shining, da-da-da-dum, you know, on and on and on. But it's the music that one remembers. Andy decides to open up the system so the prisoners in the yard can hear the music. As the melodious voices float across the prison yard, all activity stops. The men listen in rapt attention to what probably was the first time they'd ever heard Mozart or classical music. They are held enraptured. Now, how many of you saw that? Oh, it's a scene I will never forget. They are held enraptured for what seems like a long time, while the officials and the warden yell for Andy to stop. He smiles and turns the music up. The warden gets some guards and they break down the door. Andy is put in solitary confinement for a week. The narrator, played by Morgan Freeman, describes the scene. The voices soar higher and farther than you can think. Possible. I'm paraphrasing, of course. It was like some exotic birds had flown in, and for one short moment, the men felt free. I don't know what the ladies were saying, but I will never forget how it made me feel. Later, the men asked Andy how he survived his confinement. It was the shortest week I ever spent, he said. They looked shocked and said, did they let you take that record player down there? And he said, no, I had it here. Here. He points to his head and his heart. Music gives us hope, he says. Music leaves something inside they can't touch. It is hope. Excuse me. Then Friedman says, hope can drive a man insane. Why did this music drive the warden into a frenzy? Why was it forbidden? Perhaps the answer lies in the word hope, and I'm just throwing out something here. I never did quite get the significance of why that music was forbidden, but I guess I should see the movie again. The warden wanted to kill any hope they had, but it was a marvelous testament to music. This warden would not allow any swearing. He made them read the Bible, but music was taboo. It's the most powerful scene I've ever witnessed and one that I will never forget. One wonders how the morale in prisons and in airports would improve if Mozart or other classical composers would be played instead of rap music. Or CNN on full volume as we're sitting there waiting for an airplane. It prevents any reading or meditating as one waits for the plane. Now, I've heard this record, this letter duet, in a recent commercial. I think it's Northwestern Mutual. And I want to play a little bit. It's very short. And I apologize that this is not a professional recording. It's just kind of a home thing. But I think you'll get the essence of how this music soars and how it must have made them feel.
Which
that one. How did you go? Okay. All right. Now that's going to be played in there. So what we just heard was the letter duet from Mozart, and that's what was so compelling and powerful in this scene. Although Mozart is not thought of as a spiritual person, I think he writes some of the most spiritual music in the world. If we waited for saints to write music, I'm afraid we wouldn't have much. Mozart and all his unsavory reputation, which might or might not be true, still sends my soul. It enraptures me. Many of the best sermons in the world are musical. Now, for instance, there's a simple little song called Whispering Hope. And I thought about that when I was choosing my title. It doesn't mention God. But what powerful a message, and how it thrills us to hear a simple little melody like that. It doesn't have to be glorious like Mozart. There's no mention of God, but it still inspires. The pioneers used music to buoy up sagging spirits. William Clayton wrote Come, Come, Ye Saints in the middle of muddy Iowa in 1846 after he heard his wife and Nauvoo had delivered a baby, and they were doing fine. It became a rallying cry on the Mormon trail, and eventually the hymn that was heard around the world. The Spirit of God was also used to give hope in wretched conditions. In the beginning of the handcart trek, the handcart song was sung with enthusiasm and lively stealth to chirp the hundreds who pushed and pulled their way across 1,300 miles. About halfway across the plains, most of these pioneers could not bear to hear the song sung because it was not anything to be thrilled about. Music inspires in other surprising ways. I think it is an intellectual spiritualism and emotional spiritualism. It doesn't have to be from a master like Mozart. I can still remember the first time I heard The Little Drummer Boy. The words, the music, the whole thing was just, it just stopped me right in my tracks. And it's just a simple little melody, but it touched me here and here. Okay, now maybe this seems far-fetched, but I can't help compare this whole prison scenario to what is happening in the Mormon church today regarding music. We are told what music we can sing, what music is appropriate, what music is spiritually uplifting. It's called Hymns of the Restoration. We not only had a Camelot concerning church history, we also had a Camelot of music in our Mormon meetings, long, maybe 20, 25 years ago, even 10. We used to sing anthems and sacred tunes, such as, O Divine Redeemer, I've sung that, and How Beautiful Upon the Mountains. Well, just like Alan said, you can't sing those words anymore, anything like that. That's too secular, I guess. I've heard Panis Angelicus. All of those beautiful songs. I remember trumpets and guitars being used in sacrament meeting. When was the last time you heard a song in sacrament meeting that you wanted to stand up and applaud? Have you ever heard a musical arrangement in sacrament meeting that made you want to stand up and applaud? Well, maybe sometimes we tell too much, Alan. You told your choir director, whoever it was, that what you were going to play. Maybe you just go ahead and play it. My husband decided about 8 years ago that he was going to play the Bach Gounod Prelude, which is Ave Maria. So he talked to the bishop's wife, who was the organist, and they just did an organ, a piano duet of this beautiful become known now as Ave Maria. And actually, he's done that twice. And I watched the reaction of the people. Some of them were just lifted up. It was just as if, oh, how thankful I am that I am hearing this. And others were. Of course, that was only a few people who really knew. I think they all knew that the theme or the melody was Ave Maria. But they didn't realize that it was originally Bach. So, anyway, this was a wonderful experience. We used to have the organ as we passed the sacrament. It kind of softened the voices of the restless children. How sad, how empty I feel at the demise of most inspiring music. Most everything we sing is legato, soft and boring. And sometimes I do yearn for something spirited. Maybe we are all enlisted would even be good at times. Whew. At least it's lively. I mentioned to our primary chorister about 5 years ago that I missed hearing the children sing songs like Jesus Once Was a Little Child. And she said some of the old songs had been cut and the emphasis now was on following the prophet. She didn't seem to notice the irony of that statement. In 1999, when I read the explanation and the insight about why we sing only hymns or hymn-like music, I became so upset that our spiritual musical journey was being downgraded, I wrote a letter to the department. Okay, dear brother, I read your article about sacrament music and the ensign, and I must say that I'm puzzled and distressed. Your assertion that only hymns or hymn-like songs in our hymnals are appropriate for sacrament meeting seems to be in direct contradiction with the name Jesus Christ and his message. Many of these hymns sing praises to Zion or Joseph Smith, not to Jesus Christ. Furthermore, when you quote Michael Moody that it takes a good song, anthem, or hymn arrangement to surpass the effectiveness of a simple hymn well performed, I would like to say which hymn, which choir. It is my opinion that you are asserting by this that our present LDS musicians are not inspired or spiritually in tune with our needs. Some of these that I have heard far surpass most of the old hymns, which are borrowed music from old England, and the lyrics are trite. Anyway, let me read you his answer. Dear Sister Kimball, I know the Lord directs the work of salvation for us and that his leaders are shepherds, as the Lord is, in guarding his flock, even nurturing and protecting us. I also know that if there is any guideline regarding the well-being of his flock that might be amiss or an error, the Lord will speedily correct it for the safety of his saints. This gives me great comfort. The music guidelines reaffirm that the ensign really is not new. Our leaders have always guided and directed those selecting music for worship settings. The Lord has called his leaders to carefully direct those who select music for such gatherings as dedications, general conference, etc. Anyway, it goes on a little bit more like that. So that's probably not a surprising answer to my letter. Now, I have noticed even, and I don't want to sound like I'm really critical, but it seems like this whole music, downgrading music, is far-reaching, because I've noticed in the Tabernacle Choir, they mainly sing hymns now in their Sunday morning program. But I heard them recently, and they just sounded glorious. They were singing with the Israeli Symphony, and it was a requiem, I think. So to go take this a little bit further, now we even have instructions about how we are to bury our loved ones. We are told that a gospel subject, such as the plan of salvation, should be discussed, and more hymns of the restoration sung. As for the burial of my loved ones and my own farewell, no thank you. I intend to have the last word about how I exit this earth. I plan my funeral, and it will include my favorite of all compositions, Something by Mozart. I remember that I was in my living room with a new tape of Mozart many years ago when I first heard Concerto for in C for flute and harp. I was transported into a higher realm of being and beauty. It seemed like such an odd pairing of instruments, but it worked. It was a sermon. It touched my soul. French dramatist Molière captured my feelings exactly with this statement in one of his plays, and I'll substitute he for I. I had never heard such music, never dreamt such music was possible. It was, I was conscious while it lasted that I could see deeper into the beauty, the sadness of things, the very heart of them, as with a new inner eye, even into eternity itself, beyond the veil. While I sometimes have to fume in silence at church with the final trumpet sounds for me to sing in a heavenly choir, and I have wrapped the drapery of my cloak, my culture about me, I will don my heavenly robes and show up to choir practice. If I have a choice to sing with any choir, I will find out where the choir books are and then choose one that includes Amazing Grace and He's Got the Whole World in His Hands. Now I want to close with this wonderful concerto for harp and flute that just is magnificent.
Thank you, Violet. Our next speaker will be Glenn Cornett. You pronounce it like the horn, huh?
All right. I, as a youngster, say ages 12 to 16, planned on a musical career as an orchestral trombonist. And by the time I was 16, I took a good look at what I wanted in a career. And I had three criteria, none of which really were answered very well by being an orchestral trombonist. Also, I by that time realized I was a much better chemist than trombonist. So similar to Dr. Eastman, I have a background in chemistry. My undergrad was chemistry. Then I did some graduate work in life sciences, including a dissertation on brain responses, deep brain responses to musical stimuli, which was much fun. I tell people my PhD was the best vacation I ever had. So let me address the overall subject of the panel briefly. Music that enlarges the soul, for me, is an interesting subject. To me, enlargement of the soul goes beyond the realm of stereotypical spiritual experience, if you will. Enlargement of the soul involves the growth of the individual and her or his ability to have a positive impact upon humanity. The three pieces here have all given me a strong desire to examine the music and myself, ultimately exploring, inspiring me to do more with my own life. And I'll get to the pieces in a bit. I'll give a bit more of my background. I have what I'm sure you would agree is a very enviable background in music and heritage of my family. About four generations back, I have a relative who was one of the finer dance fiddlers in Appalachian coal mine in Kentucky. My grandfather had his own picking and singing song on the radio show. So roughly my musical heritage comes out at family reunions when there will be roughly a dozen guitar players, at least half a dozen people who have composed their own music, and so on and so forth. And I fit in very poorly in these backgrounds. My musical experience in terms of things I have ambitiously studied, analyzed, composed, performed, has pretty much done everything but bluegrass music. I've done some Indian classical music, a large amount of sort of Western common practice period in classical music, if you will, quite a bit of jazz, quite a bit of what I now refer to as amplified string ensemble music or rock and roll. Just how I kind of break the news to my classical friends as to what I've been doing with my life lately. So, that said, I studied to be a trombonist for years, ended up picking up keyboards toward the end of my high school years, which for me was very emancipating because I could compose, you know, harmonies, actually, and do, of course, a lot with words. I enjoy poetry, both others, and much more than my own, probably, for good reason. But I do mix the two. Then my keyboard writing became very complex. Part of the problem being a trombonist is there's not a lot written among the earlier players, people except for liturgical music. But you look at the large orchestral pieces that are likely to be played by the Utah Symphony. First major work was probably Mozart's Requiem, and which I found a bit insulting. He said, "Okay, now that I'm about to die, you can put a trombone in one of my pieces, right?" And then after that, you basically wait till Beethoven's Fifth, where great trombone parts. Then you don't hear again until Beethoven's Ninth, and Beethoven's Fifth, I think, was 1804 or so. So you have to get pretty well into the history of classical music. Then you get over to some things that quickly pick up speed by the time you get to Stravinsky in the early 20th century. Very interesting, very fun, a lot of asymmetric time signatures and all that. But this bred in me a strong taste for dissonance and asymmetric time signatures and so forth. So it got to the point that my brother, who was somewhat of a fan of harsh and dissonant music himself, said he had trouble listening to my music because it was a bit too complex. So I figured the way to fix that was to pick up guitar, which I couldn't play at all at the moment. So it forced me to get back to simpler music, which I did for at least a couple years. So my journey has been quite enjoyable, and I've occasionally picked up a few shekels here and there. But give you an idea of what I do with my nefarious life at the moment. My remarks are scrawled on the back of a press release from a biotechnology company headquartered a couple miles from my Palo Alto home, and that's how I finance all my hobbies. I do business, basically. What Neil Chandler blithely refers to as revealed free market capitalism. I got to a certain point in my life and realized that not all businessmen are stupid and immoral, and some of these guys are actually interesting. But then I get away from that, and I hang around with musicians as well, and that's sometimes a bit more fun. Kim McCall, by the way, on the front row here, is one of my partners in crime. He performed with me the first piece I'll show you in a bit. And more recently, we performed some Simon and Garfunkel at a church 4th of July picnic, which was lots of fun. So our dean talks about his life right now. He goes to his ward a few times a year and hits about 150 concerts. I'm kind of the reverse. I probably hit about 150 church meetings a year, if you count three meetings a, you know, a week, and then the ancillary ones, and then the ones I miss because I'm on business trips and such. Let me tell you what my favorite missed church experience. I have perhaps become criminally comfortable with dress shirts with medium starch, and I feel I must wear them to Mormon church meetings, which is kind of silly. But I was in London on business and ended up with more business meetings than I planned on this one trip, and I was quickly running out of shirts with medium starch. So my solution was not to go to a Mormon church, but go to a church where they were more casual in the dress code. I, of course, chose Westminster Abbey for the music. So I show up in I think, this jacket and a golf shirt, you know, with a collar at least. And they gave me a very nice seat because it was much better, much more nicely dressed than most of the people who were, you know, in their jeans and T-shirts, what have you. So it was kind of ironic that I went to Westminster Abbey and felt I could dress down for that. But there's our wonderful culture. Frankly, I could have gone to the Hyde Park Board and they would have accepted me. They all knew me. I was just a bit socially embarrassed, so it was probably my problem, not the church's. And it was also a great excuse to go hear some good music, since the church does not generally cater to people who are trained musicians in terms of, you know, their regulations on you know, correlation, if you will, on music. So, anyway, I don't go to nearly as many concerts as I'd like to right now because I have a wife and three children, and I feel guilty spending too much time away from my family. My most intensive musical experiences frequently are during business trips. For a while, I had guitars stashed in London, New York, and Boston at various hotels so that, you know, I could get in practice when people weren't looking. Music has pretty much become my mistress. It's the sort of thing I do when my wife isn't looking. So, and it's a lot cheaper than having a mistress, especially if you get caught, I imagine. So, that said, let me go over three pieces here. I was assuming, and not completely often assuming, that most of the pieces displayed here would be a common practice period, you know, say, starting with Bach or Vivaldi and ending maybe in the time of, let's say, Schumann or Wagner, or maybe Stravinsky is not common practice, but, you know, 20th century classical music that they'll still play at the Utah Symphony. Sort of thing. So I'm bracketing that with one very old piece and then a couple of fairly modern. The first one I'll play is the Michel Notre Dame Mass, which, according to this, the liner notes here was probably written for February 2nd, which happened to have been my daughter's 8th birthday and the day on which she was baptized. So to me, it screamed, you know, performance at your daughter's baptism. And there were a couple very nervous people, and the rest of them were very accommodating, including the bishop and such. In fact, the only person that was really nervous was one of the people performing. He was recently put on high council, so I guess that's the sort of people that get put on high council, people that are nervous about, you know, uttering three words in Greek at a church service. So because this was the Kyrie movement, which was in Greek, right? The form of the Kyrie is Kyrie eleison, Christe eleison, Kyrie eleison. That's pretty much the entire lyric, if you will, and it means Lord have mercy, Christ have mercy, Lord have mercy. Lovely, lovely piece here. This was written roughly in 1363, about 120 years before the birth of Martin Luther, to give you an idea. This is when music really was Catholic in Christianity, at least in Western Europe. This recording is a bit controversial because it actually employs some Eastern Orthodox nuances in the way it's performed, but I think it is just beautiful. It's a 10-minute movement, and you'll hear a couple minutes of it.
Thank you.
apologies for that. I don't know if it's my disc or the equipment. All right, this next piece. Now let's fast forward a brief 600 years or so. This came out in 1975. There's an entire genre of music now referred to as ambient music. And one of the pioneers, at least, was Brian Eno. Who's quite closely associated with this were the minimalist composers. And in fact, this is considered minimalist work by most, I would think. Steve Reich, Philip Glass, who wrote Einstein on the Beach? John Adams, I believe, right? Those are sort of the composers that write for orchestral instruments, this sort of music. Again, this came out in 75. Was actually the result, first of all, of the composer having been involved in an auto accident and having been given a piece of recording, which he played back and had set the volume too low, but he was too incapacitated to get up and fix it. But he decided to begin appreciating it as a part of the environment, ambience, if you will. And so this is the very first of his pieces. I will play for you what is the second cut on here, which is one of his three variations on Pachelbel's Canon. And this was actually my first exposure to Pachelbel's Canon. And it's, let's just say, some of my friends that were more starchy Pachelbel fans had digestive troubles. But I do think this is a wonderful piece. The artist, by the way, Brian Eno, is a very eclectic person. His first real musical appearance on the scene was with a British band known as Roxy Music, and then he has since developed a lot of, produced a lot of Talking Heads albums. David Bowie, U2 is probably his most famous work. He also has some personal habits that would make Mozart blush, I think, and which I'm reluctant even to discuss in a Sunstone meeting, all right? But my view is that a lot of great artists, great leaders, great people don't necessarily have the sort of habits I'd want to see in myself or my children. But nonetheless, they make great contributions. This last one is what you'd probably call fusion. It's the first solo album by Bill Bruford, who is an amazing talent. He, at 17 years old, joined the group Yes, with whom some of you may be familiar, one of the sort of progressive rock bands. He left Yes because they weren't sufficiently challenging for King Crimson, who were one of the more challenging bands out there, and they're still making albums, you know, heck, 31 years later. So they're an interesting group. At any rate, this is his solo album, and he does no drum solos on it, though he is the drummer, but rather put together some superb musicians. And the guitarist, which I'll play you basically a couple minutes of guitar solo. The guitarist is Alan Holdsworth, considered by Eddie Van Halen, among others, to be about the best guitarist around. But a superbly talented guitarist. And what you have here is a framework set up by the composer Bill Bruford, the drummer, that allows some harmonic context that I think is very well constructed. And then on top of that, Alan Holdsworth plays this gorgeous guitar solo that continues to build and build and build in the appropriate context of the music, and is as well executed as much legitimate music that I've ever seen. So the trick here is that I have to get this to 2 minutes and 30 seconds into the song, and my fear is, which is answered here, I think, is that you can't do that here. So please be a wee bit patient. I'm sure not all people find that inspiring, but that's certainly one of those things that would wake me up and get me going in the morning, I suppose. Look, that music does continue to be a subjective experience, and it's clearly the subjective experiences of people on the Correlation Committee differ from those of professional musicians. One shouldn't be too mystified as the church gets increasingly correlated, as it were. One also might hope that we're sort of at one sort of end of the pendulum swing there, as it were. We'll see. Music for me continues to be a source of inspiration and hope. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Violet, Alan, Ardeen, and Glenn, and thank you for coming to this session. The session is now officially concluded. If you'd like to ask some questions, we can do that for a few minutes. If anyone has questions. Yes?
I read your account, you say what? Just give us a piece of.
Oh, thank you. I had some major healing, emotional healing and spiritual healing to do. It took me many years, and the music that really helped me do that was the slow parts of Appalachian Spring. Bernstein's Chichester Psalms. The middle section of it is based on Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd," and it's sung by a boy soprano. Boy sopranos just have gorgeous voices. And it's so pure. And he sings this, "The Lord is my shepherd," in Hebrew or Aramaic. I think it's Hebrew. And then the third piece was John Rutter's Requiem. John Rutter is a contemporary British composer of choral music. I love choral music. But there's nothing that is quite as wonderful as being a performer, being inside an orchestra and a chorus that creates this beautiful sound, and you're part of it. It's just really cool. This gentleman back here.
Been there, done that.
Any more resounding endorsements by musical taste?
Yes.
It's been a beautiful sessions to have a chance to heal and meditate with music. Wonderful power. Oh. In our old chapel, Taylorsville, we had a oil painting of Christ praying in Gethsemane. My father had been bishop, and I think someone in the ward who they'd helped, a painter, had been out of work, and they'd helped him, and they commissioned him to do this magnificent painting. So during the sacrament, I used to look up and see that painting. Well, the organist played the music on the organ. It wasn't an electric organ. My aunt was the music director, and my dad was the bishop, and they made sure they bought this wonderful pipe organ. And when they left that church, it's no longer that, to the big now stake center, that organ went with them. But I don't know what happened to the oil painting or the stained glass window that was at the back. I miss that art, along with the music.
Thank you.
I have a two-part question for Arneen. Does your broad definition of music include heavy metal and rap? It makes no exception. My definition of music makes no exception at all.
Okay.
But I definitely prefer some over other.
Okay.
But my definition allows all persons into the fold, and I've tried it all.
Can I add something to that, Cardi? In 1862, Brigham Young said, "There is no music in hell because all good music belongs to God." But I don't think Brigham Young had heard some of the things we are hearing.
But yet the operative word is all good. Well, okay, Artie, then the second question, how can that cerebral, that Krita, enlighten us and uplift us? It's not cerebral. And it definitely is excreta. Because we all communicate. We all excrete from our minds and our feelings that which is important to us. And sure, you choose what you eat, you choose where you'll sleep, and you choose what you'll read and how you worship, and you should do all of those things. And there's no obligation for you or anybody to try anything. But for me, who was born so curious, I have to try all of that stuff. And the nice thing about music is
that when it's over, and you don't have to go to jail for trying. That is, if you can have an extraordinary experience into the mind and psyche of another individual without indeed having to live their lives in all of the, you know, all of the downside of that. So I think that music, which for me would even be broader and include all literature and art and everything, all art tells us, informs us about life. And it's all significant. It all means something. Yesterday there was a glorious film shown in the afternoon, as touching as anything I've ever seen. But it was dark. That is, it really opened up the dark side of being human. And if Mozart, with all of his light, is remembered because he had a way of presenting darkness. That
magic flute.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I don't eliminate anything at all. I don't love it all, but I do. I think it's all worthy of being examined and be thoughtful about. So I listen to rap. I listen to heavy metal. You can't get heavier than the stuff I listen to. I even subjected my wife 30 years ago to a concert. I just couldn't believe I was actually that. And I think people came away from that the wiser.
Incidentally, those are questions about music in the church. This isn't necessarily a commercial, but I bought this yesterday and read it yesterday and last night, and this is a wonderful history of how closed-minded, open-minded, perverse, enlightened by terms music in the church has been. It's really fascinating. Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir?
Maybe it's too late. Just take briefly. Briefly, I'm a trumpet player that had played, started out in World War II in an army band, and my one of my main experiences has been with medical doctor musicians. I've known four or five trumpet players play very well, and so let me end this so that we can go on to the next one. Remember the song Body and Soul? This is the best session I've been to right here now because of the.
Thank you.
Music.
And Western culture in general, but specifically music.
I'll look.